Good afternoon. So I've been given four questions to go over with you. So the first question, is there any benefit in treating residents with asymptomatic bacteria? Certainly we wouldn't want to do things unless we do have a benefit. But even more importantly, could there be harm, in which case we should completely avoid it? So prospective randomized trials of screening for or treating asymptomatic bacteria have shown, number one, no decrease in the rate of symptomatic infection. In other words, if you find people with greater than 10 to the 5, but they have no symptoms and you treat them, you will not prevent them from going on to a full-blown symptomatic infection. Secondly, it does not improve survival. And thirdly, there's no change in chronic genitourinary symptoms like incontinence before or after treatment of people with asymptomatic bacteria. This is an interesting study. They had 172 nursing home residents who had an abnormal urinalysis, and these did not have a fold. 146 did not meet criteria for treatment because they had no symptoms. 76 of those were not treated. Interesting, the study, they treated half the people that shouldn't have been treated. But of those they didn't treat, guess what happened? Nothing. Nobody developed adverse consequences from not being treated with their greater than 10 to the 5 E. coli with no symptoms. No deaths or hospitalizations were attributed to worsening infection or sepsis occurring during the following 3 months. So there was no downside to not treat. Now the question is, suppose you have an incontinent resident and they have greater than 10 to the 5 bacteria in the urine. Will it help the incontinence? The answer is no. Here's baseline incontinence with frequency, with the percent of checks that are wet. Here's after you treated that asymptomatic bacteria, basically zero. So the fact that a resident has asymptomatic bacteria and incontinence, they're not related, and you can't improve it by treating it. By 6 to 8 weeks after treating asymptomatic patients with bacteria, 60 to 80% are going to have another positive urine culture. So what I saw when I first started working in long-term care facilities is this pattern of physicians getting a urine culture in an asymptomatic person. Oh, it's greater than 10 to the 5. Now they treat it. Then they come back and get a test of cure culture, which, guess what, is going to be positive almost all the time. But there's a difference. Now the bacteria is resistant to what you treated the first time. And you get in this recurring cycle of upping the ante, and you get nothing. So actually what they found is those who receive antimicrobial therapy have increased frequency of adverse events from the antibiotics. They have increased reinfection of resistant organisms, and therefore increased cost because you're increasing the ante with these more expensive antibiotics. And this was back to that same study. Now, what happened to those residents that shouldn't have been treated, but they went ahead and treated them? We know the ones they didn't treat did fine. The other ones didn't do as well. 85% of the patients did not meet criteria for treatment, but somebody went ahead and treated them 41% of the time. 12% of all of the patients who received treatment developed C. diff. 12%. Overall, those who received inappropriate antibiotics were 8 times more likely to get C. diff than those that were just left alone with their asymptomatic bacteria. In fact, one of the biggest risk factors for C. diff, if you go back in the charts, is somebody had a positive urine culture. And it's not because of the urine culture, it's because of what somebody did about the urine culture. This is mortality in elderly men. You notice that it's higher in those who receive treatment for the asymptomatic bacteria than those who are left alone. Look at women, it's even more impressive. So mortality is actually higher in those who get treated for asymptomatic bacteria than those that are left alone. So asymptomatic bacteria is universal in subjects who have long-term indwelling catheters. Antimicrobial therapy will not prevent bacteria or the development of a symptomatic infection, but it will lead to side effects, increasing resistance and cost. So asymptomatic bacteria should not be treated with or without a Foley catheter. Thus, antibiotics are not indicated for the treatment of asymptomatic UTI in the residents of long-term care facilities. And we ought to just drop that concept of asymptomatic UTI. Yeah. Just call it asymptomatic bacteria, because that's all it is. It's not an infection. Okay, so the second question I was given, oops, got my water. I've got laryngitis, so I'm praying that I can last the 20 minutes. How do I decide which resident to treat for a suspected UTI? For residents in long-term care facilities who don't have a Foley, as Dr. Palmer mentioned, up to 50% of women and 40% of men are going to have greater than 10 to the 5 E. coli. So if you go down the hall and people are sitting there reading their newspaper and you get a urine culture, you can flip a coin. 50% of them are going to have a positive culture. Doesn't mean you treat them, because you're not going to do them any good. At the same time, though, urinary tract infection is the most common cause of bacteremia in long-term care facility residents, and it's a common cause of acute care transfers. So how do I separate the large number of asymptomatic patients with bacteria in the urine who don't need treatment from that much smaller group who need treatment for their infection? So the first question, well, how about if I've got pyuria? Wouldn't that help? I've got greater than 10 to the 5 E. coli. Maybe if I've got white cells, that's going to help me make the decision. And the answer is no, it doesn't help. 90% of residents with asymptomatic bacteria will have white blood cells in their urine or pyuria. It's extremely common to have pyuria, and it doesn't help you at all. In fact, 30% of all residents who don't even have bacteria in the urine will have pyuria or white cells in their urine. High rates are related to genital, bladder, prostate, and renal inflammation. The one thing that does help is the absence of pyuria. If you don't have white cells on the UA, it's essentially 100% predictive they don't have a urinary tract infection. So I always pray for the negative UA. Then I know what I've got. If I've got a positive UA, I still don't know anything, because half of them are going to have abnormal positive cultures, and 90% of them are going to have abnormal UAs. How about the way the urine looks? Foul smelling, cloudy urine. Many people have tried to use that, but it turns out that neither foul smell or cloudy urine have been clearly associated with symptomatic UTI. How about, excuse me, fever and asymptomatic bacteria? A common diagnostic dilemma is the presence of fever with no localizing findings in a resident who has bacteria and pyuria. Interestingly, only 10% of these episodes are attributable to a urinary source in residents who do not have an indwelling Foley. So 90% of the time, it's not going to be the urinary tract if they don't have a Foley. If they have a Foley, it's a different story. What about clinical deterioration as deciding whether you have a urinary tract infection? UTI has been used as an explanation for clinical deterioration. UTI was a cause of clinical deterioration in only 11% of episodes, and every single time if the UTI caused a clinical deterioration, they were febrile. So a resident who had clinical deterioration, positive urine culture, positive UA, if they don't have a fever, it's almost 90% likely that they don't have a urinary tract infection as a cause of clinical deterioration. I mean, how many times do you transfer somebody out to a hospital, and the first thing they do is get a urine culture, and it's abnormal, they say, oh, it's a UTI. Yeah. And then they treat it and send it back to you, and they haven't gotten even close to what really caused it. I'd say that's the drill, I think, at the receiving hospital, because it makes it easy for them, right? They flip a coin, it's going to be abnormal, now I've got an explanation. So an acute deterioration in stable chronic symptoms may indicate acute infection. Multiple coexisting findings such as fever with hematuria are more likely to indicate a urinary source. In someone with nonspecific symptoms such as a change in functional or mental status, bacteria alone does not necessarily warrant antibiotic treatment. Although sepsis, including urosepsis, can cause dizziness or falling, there is not clear evidence linking bacteria or a localized UTI to an increased fall risk. So UTI is a clinically detectable condition associated with invasion of disease causing microorganisms of the some part of the urinary tract. A positive urine culture will show bacteria, but that alone is not enough to diagnose a symptomatic UTI. A negative leukocyte esterase or absence of pyuria is great. It strongly suggests UTI is not present. A positive leukocyte esterase test or pyuria really doesn't help you much. So clinically, the healthcare provider is faced with a real diagnostic dilemma. Indwelling bladder catheter is the number one risk for bacteremia in long-term care facilities, but essentially all urine cultures will be positive in residents with chronic catheterization. So who do you treat? Urinalysis and urine culture are only really helpful if negative. Then you've excluded a UTI. Fever is the most frequent clinical presentation of UTI in the chronically catheterized resident. Catheter obstruction, that's usually when they get septic. It's when that catheter gets obstructed. So it's often a precipitating event for fever and systemic infection. So fever with hematuria or catheter obstruction has a high probability of being from a urinary source. That's really what you're looking for. So because many residents have chronic bacteria, the research-based literature suggests treating only symptomatic UTIs. And how do we diagnose them? So this is, again, how we diagnose them. Same thing Dr. Palmer showed you. This is patients without a without a catheter, fever, new urinary symptoms, new flank or suprapubic pain or tenderness, changing character of urine, new bloody urine, or a lab report with new pyuria, or microscopic hematuria. Works when you have mental or functional status, but you notice you need at least three. So decreasing functional status in an abnormal UA is not enough. You really need three before you get to the point where you're going to treat. Now, with a catheter, you need two: fever, chills, new flank pain, changing character of urine, worsening of mental status or function. But again, you need two, and local findings such as obstruction, leakage, or mucosal trauma, those are really your tips that the ante's going up for it actually being an infection. So, third question, how should I treat a UTI? Should I remove the Foley, and then which antibiotic should I choose? This is a very interesting study by Raz, and I actually presented this to urology residents a couple of years, about 3 years ago, and they were shocked at the concept.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah. I'll leave.
About removing the catheter before you get your culture. It was kind of a new idea. When a patient has fever and the source is felt to be the urinary tract in a patient with a chronic Foley catheter, there's a more rapid response and a lower rate of recurrent symptoms if the Foley is changed prior to initiation of antibiotics. So that's key. What you've got is this Foley with an encrustation and a biofilm, the bacteria down inside of it. You can't kill the bacteria in the biofilm. So what you're culturing and treating is the floating bacteria. You kill those, and then what's going to happen as soon as you stop the antibiotic? They come right back out of the biofilm. So it's just a guarantee you're going to have a relapse. So if urine culture is obtained from the old catheter, culture is polymicrobial in 52%. There's only 11% if you change the catheter. What does polymicrobial mean? You've got three or four different bacteria, so you're going to have a much broader and more expensive antibiotic to cover all of these guys you got, and most of them are just colonizers. The real answer is that fresh catheter without a biofilm, and you drop your rate of polymicrobial cultures to 11%. Patients who had a catheter change before treatment responded faster to treatment and had a much lower relapse rate at 28 days, 11 versus 41%. So if you suspect a urinary tract infection in somebody with a catheter, get the catheter out, the old one, put a fresh one in, that's when you get your urine culture and your UA. And then if it's abnormal and you decide you need to treat, you're going to get a faster response, less relapse. Leave the catheter in and you're just, the cycle just keep going. As far as choosing which antibiotic choose for UTI, you have to be aware of what your local sensitivity patterns are, and I'll go over them for Centera and show you a few things. You have to balance efficacy of the antibiotic against what we call collateral damage from the antibiotic. And that would mean the side effect of the antibiotic, of C. diff, and antibiotic side effects. If they've had an antibiotic in the last 3 to 6 months, it's definitely going to increase the risk of resistance. For acute cystitis, you want to avoid any antibiotic that your antibiogram says you've got more than 20% resistance. And you can use 20% because if you fail, it's just local symptoms, it's not sepsis. But for potential pyelonephritis, when you've got flank pain, fever, you don't want to use an antibiotic with more than 10% resistance. So here are local patterns for this whole Centera system. And you can see about half are resistant to ampicillin, 35% resistance to Cipro. That's a very high rate of resistance. 27% to Bactrim or Ceftra. But look at this nitrofurantoin, macrobantin. Only 7% resistance. And in the parentheses, that's what you'd expect with women 16 to 45 in the community. I think our long-term care facilities are going to be more with these higher resistance patterns. So what does the new international guidelines say? The new international guidelines says, number one, first drug of choice, nitrofurantoin, macrodantin. You can do macrodantin, macrobid, furodantin, 100 milligrams twice daily, and now for 5 days. It's shown you don't need that 7 days. So macrodantin for 5 days. The acute or subacute chronic pulmonary reactions to macrodantin are actually quite rare, and usually only in chronic therapy, and it's less than 1 in 100,000. So if you're treating acute cystitis, it's really not going to be a problem. Remember that macrodantin is not excreted in the urine if the creatinine clearance is under 60. So you can't use macrodantin in that situation. The other issue is it doesn't get any tissue penetration and does not get blood levels. So it's strictly for cystitis. It is not for the suspected pyelo. But you're going to very rarely have resistance if you're using macrodantin for symptomatic urinary tract infections in the lower urinary tract. Now, the second recommendation is for Bactrim. You're going to use a double strength, twice daily for 3 days. And I gave you some of the adjustments for renal insufficiency. By the time your creatinine gets under 50, actually you're relying on the trimethoprim, which actually gets very nice levels, even down to very low kidney function. You'll still get trimethoprim in the urine. Now this is kind of interesting. What happens if you have a resident who has a Bactrim-resistant E. coli? But of course, you didn't know it because you started treatment empirically when you sent off the urine culture. Now it comes back abnormal. If they're resistant, you're going to get a clinical failure rate of about half versus only 4% if they're sensitive. So you get a tenfold increase in failure rate. But notice you do get some successes, almost half, even though they're resistant. And it's because the urinary concentrations of trimethoprim are 100-fold higher than the serum. And in microbiology, we use the same breakpoint for a urine isolate or a blood isolate. We don't take into account the fact you get a lot more antibiotic in the urine. So actually, some of the residents, well, by the time the urine culture comes back and says it's Bactrim resistant, they'll have no symptoms. The alternatives then, not first line. And the issue here is because of increasing collateral damage with a risk for C. difficile. And actually, it's been shown that the quinolones actually increase MRSA colonization. So they are not considered front line for UTI in the lower urinary tract. And the dose is 250 of Cipro twice a day for 3 days. Levaquin is a reasonable option depending on what your hospital stocks. Remember that moxifloxacin is not. It doesn't get in the urine. It's not approved for UTIs, and it's a big mistake I see in acute care hospitals. People trying to use Avalox to treat UTIs. It's not going to work. Now this is, what about Cipro resistance? So you sent out urine culture, you started the Cipro. Very interesting, Cipro often works even when it's Cipro resistant. And so in this study, they had 87 adults with a UTI with an organism resistant to ciprofloxacin, but then who were treated with Cipro. 75% had a microbiologic cure, and 77% had a clinical response to Cipro despite resistance. So twice the response of Bactrim in the face of resistance. Pseudomonas had a lower response, about 46%, so a Cipro-resistant Pseudomonas, you're probably not going to get a winner, but about half the time. But for E. coli, you can get as high as an 80% response rate, even with Cipro resistance. And the issue here is for ciprofloxacin, less than or equal to 1 microgram is susceptible. 2 micrograms, if it'll grow in 2 micrograms, it's intermediate, and greater than 4 is resistant. But we use the same breakpoints for serum and urine. But look at what we've got in the urine. We've got 100 times more Cipro in the urine than we have in the serum. And I think that's why Cipro will often work in a lower urinary tract infection, even though there's resistance. Other alternative therapies would include Augmentin and cephalosporins, although they're less active than any of those preceding, and they have an even higher risk of C. diff. Now, one thing that I found very, very helpful in long-term care facilities where there's very high resistance rates is fosfomycin or Monurol. This is an antibiotic that hasn't been used in a long time. It comes in a sachet. The one sachet is good for 48 to 72 hours with completely therapeutic levels for 3 days. In the bladder, it gets great tissue concentrations, actually has tissue concentrations in the kidneys, in the prostate, and in the blood. Downside is it's about $47 for each one of those sachets, but it's good against MRSA, VRE, ESBL, most gram-negative rods, and even a fair amount of Pseudomonas. So Monurol is something I have been able to kind of pull out as an oral antibiotic and prevent having to use a systemic antibiotic in people. It's relatively well tolerated. There's a little bit of number of patients have gotten some diarrhea, but it's pretty tolerable. How long do you treat? If you have a urinary tract infection, even with pyelo associated with an indwelling Foley, 5 to 7 days, and of course resolution of symptoms. So it's a relatively short course. It's not 14 to 21 days. Now, for pyelonephritis, where you've got the flank pain, high fever, you're thinking you've got a kidney infection, if you don't think the resident needs hospitalization, then you can go ahead and start with your ciprofloxacin. Even those high levels of resistance, hopefully we'll get some activity, but I think given our local rates, I would probably also use a long-acting parenteral antimicrobial, either ceftriaxone or a dose of single daily dose of aminoglycoside while I was waiting for my culture result and UA to come back. And the duration here is going to be 10 to 14 days. So any questions about treatment? Okay, so I'll go on to, should I do a test of cure culture? And this I hate. I hate test of cure culture. You don't do it because it's going to be positive. So the goal of treating a UTI is to alleviate symptoms. Remember, we don't treat asymptomatic urinary tract infections. So the only reason you're treating is to make the symptoms go away. You're not going to get the bacteria to go away because it's just going to come back 60, 80% of the time. Your only goal is to get rid of the symptoms. So if the symptoms are gone, you're done. You're out of there. Don't get a repeat culture because what's going to happen? It's going to be positive, but it's going to be a more resistant organism. And then your little mind's going to start to work. And next thing I know, you're going to be starting another antibiotic. And then you're going to say, well, I better look again, and you're going to be in trouble. So is the resident. So therefore, post-treatment culture is not routinely necessary, but may be useful in certain situations, and I know of only one. Continued bacteriuria without residual symptoms does not warrant repeat or continued antibiotic therapy. It's only the symptoms you worry about. Now, the only reason I can think of to repeat a culture is if you're in a facility and they're in isolation and you're trying to get them out of isolation. So for VRE, you actually need 3 cultures 1 week apart from the stool and the source. So if it was a VRE UTI, then you'd be culturing the urine, not to find to treat VRE if it's there again, but just to see if it's cleared. And same thing for MRSA, ESBL. The only indication of repeated culture is trying to get them out of isolation. Generally, acute care hospitals, we never try and get them out of isolation. They're in for the duration. And I frankly would not do a lot of chasing of trying to get people out of isolation. if the repeat urine culture is positive, treatment is only indicated the resident's symptomatic, because you're not using treatment to get rid of colonization. You're only treating symptoms. You're not treating cultures. Retreatment is not used to eradicate colonization in an ACE or in an asymptomatic resident. Okay. Maybe we'll move on to the... And my voice almost made it.
Hung in there.